the only colonial empire still in existence. It may therefore be that these ideological positions occupied by the forces of Marxism may one day be conquered by the West, but this presupposes that the latter, in their indirect strategy, have learned the value of thinking and calculating, instead of merely trying to apply juridical or moral principles which their enemy can use against them at every turn. From The Mind of War, John Boyd and American Security, by Grant T. Hammond. How should a regime pursue a counter-guerrilla campaign? Colonel John Boyd laid out an array of tools. Undermine the guerrillas' cause and destroy their cohesion by demonstrating integrity and competence of government to represent and serve the needs of the people, rather than exploit and impoverish them for the benefit of a greedy elite. If you cannot realize such a political program, Boyd noted, you might consider changing sides now to avoid the rush later. Take political initiative to root out and visibly punish corruption. Select new leaders with recognized competence as well as popular appeal. Ensure that they deliver justice, eliminate major grievances, and connect the government with its grassroots. From Rules for Radicals, by Saul D. Alinsky. It is a world not of angels, but of angles, where men speak of moral principles, but act on power principles. A world where we are always moral, and our enemies always immoral. The Concept of the Political, by Carl Schmitt. Humanity as such cannot wage war because it has no enemy, at least not on this planet. The concept of humanity excludes the concept of the enemy because the enemy does not cease to be a human being, and hence there is no specific differentiation in that concept. That wars are waged in the name of humanity is not a contradiction of this simple truth. Quite the contrary, it has an especially intensive political meaning. When a state fights its political enemy in the name of humanity, it is not a war for the sake of humanity, but a war wherein a particular state seeks to usurp a universal concept against its military opponent. At the expense of its opponent, it tries to identify itself with humanity in the same way as one can misuse peace, justice, progress, and civilization in order to claim these as one's own and to deny the same to the enemy. The concept of humanity is an especially useful ideological instrument of imperialistic expansion, and in its ethical humanitarian form, it is a specific vehicle of economic imperialism. Here one is reminded of a somewhat modified expression of Proudhon's. Whoever invokes humanity wants to cheat. To confiscate the word humanity, to invoke and monopolize such a term, probably has certain incalculable effects, such as denying the enemy the quality of being human and declaring him to be an outlaw of humanity. And a war can thereby be driven to the most extreme inhumanity. And lastly, by Thomas Hobbes. Successful wickedness hath obtained the name virtue when it is for the getting of the kingdom. Chapter 26. Deny Them Targets. The Strategy of the Void. The feeling of emptiness or void, silence, isolation, non-engagement with others, is for most people intolerable. As a human weakness, that fear offers fertile ground for a powerful strategy. Give your enemies no target to attack. Be dangerous, but elusive and invisible. Then watch as they chase you into the void. This is the essence of guerrilla warfare. Instead of frontal battles, deliver irritating but damaging side attacks and pinprick bites. Frustrated at their inability to use their strength against your vaporous campaign, your opponents will grow irrational and exhausted. Make your guerrilla war part of a grand political cause, a people's war, that crests in an irresistible revolution. The Lure of the Void. In 1807, Napoleon Bonaparte of France and Tsar Alexander I of Russia signed a treaty of alliance. Now the period's two great military powers were linked. But this treaty was unpopular with the Russian court. Among other things, it allowed Napoleon nearly free rein in Poland, Russia's traditional front yard. Russian aristocrats worked to influence the Tsar to repudiate it. Before too long, Alexander began to take actions that he knew would displease the French, and by August 1811, Napoleon had had enough. It was time to teach Russia a lesson. He began to lay plans for an invasion. The acquisition of this vast territory to the east would make him the ruler of the largest empire in history. Some of Napoleon's ministers warned him of the dangers of invading such a vast country, but the Emperor General felt supremely confident. The Russian army was undisciplined, and its officers were squabbling among themselves. Two forces in Lithuania were positioned to block an invasion from the west, but intelligence had revealed that they were unprepared. Napoleon would march into a central position between these forces and defeat them in detail. He would ensure victory by mobilizing an army three times larger than any he had previously led. 650,000 men would march into Russia, 450,000 as part of the main attack force, the rest to secure lines of communication and supply. With an army this size, he could dominate even the large spaces of Russia, overwhelming the feeble enemy not only with his usual brilliant maneuvers, but with superior firepower. Napoleon may have felt certain of victory, but he was not a reckless man. As always, he studied the situation from every angle. He knew, for instance, that Russian roads were notoriously bad. Local food supplies were meager. The climate tended to extremes of heat and cold, and the vast distances made it much harder to encircle the enemy. There was always room to retreat. He read up on the failed invasion of Russia by the King of Sweden, Charles XII, in 1709, and anticipated that the Russians might revert to a scorched earth policy. His army would have to be as self-sufficient as possible. The distances were too great to have extended supply lines from Europe. But given its size, that would require incredible planning and organization. To help provide for his army, Napoleon had vast storehouses close to the borders of Russia filled with wheat and rice. He knew it would be impossible to provide fodder for the 150,000 horses of his army, and so thinking ahead, he decided they would have to wait until June for the invasion, when the grasses of the Russian plains would be rich and green. At the last minute, he learned Russia had very few mills to grind grain into flour, so he added to his growing list the need to bring materials to build mills along the way. With the logistical problems addressed and his usual well-devised strategy in hand, Napoleon told his ministers that he foresaw complete victory within 3 weeks. In the past, these predictions of Napoleon's had been uncannily accurate. In June 1812, Napoleon's vast armada of men and supplies crossed into Russia. Napoleon always planned for the unexpected, but this time, unmanageable difficulties began to pile up almost immediately. Rain, the bad roads, the intense summer heat brought the army's movements to a crawl. Within days, more than 10,000 horses ate rank grass and died. Supplies were failing to reach the forward troops fast enough, and they had to resort to foraging. But the uncooperative Russian peasants along the march not only refused to sell their food at any price, but burned their hay rather than let the French have it. More French horses died when they were forced to feed off the thatch in the roofs of houses, only to find the houses collapsing on them. The two Russian armies in Lithuania retreated too fast to be caught, and as they went, they burned crops and destroyed all storehouses of food. Dysentery quickly spread through the French troops. Some 900 men died each day. In his effort to catch and destroy at least a part of his elusive enemy, Napoleon was compelled to march ever farther east. At points he came tantalizingly close to the more northern of the two Russian armies, but his exhausted men and horses could not move fast enough to meet or encircle it, and it easily escaped his traps each time. June bled into July. Now it became clear that the Russians would be able to join their two armies at Smolensk, over 200 miles east of where Napoleon had intended to fight them, and a mere 280 miles from Moscow. Napoleon had to call a halt and rethink his plan. Thousands of French soldiers had succumbed to disease and hunger without a single battle being fought. The army was strung out along a 500-mile line, parts of which were constantly harassed by small troops of Cossacks on horseback, sowing terror with their bloodthirsty raids. Napoleon could not allow the chase to go on any longer. He would march his men to Smolensk and fight the decisive battle there. Smolensk was a holy city, with great emotional significance to the Russian people. Surely the Russians would fight to defend it rather than let it be destroyed. He knew that if he could only meet the Russians in battle, he would win. And so the French moved on Smolensk, arriving there in mid-August, their 450,000-man attack force reduced to 150,000 and worn down by the intense heat. Finally, as Napoleon had predicted, the Russians made a stand here, but only briefly. After several days of fighting, they retreated yet again, leaving behind a burned and ruined city with nothing in it to feed on or plunder. Napoleon could not understand the Russian people, who seemed to him suicidal. They would destroy their country rather than surrender it. Now he had to decide whether to march on Moscow itself. It might have seemed wise to wait through the winter at Smolensk, but that would give the Tsar time to raise a larger army that would prove too hard for Napoleon to handle with his own depleted forces. The French emperor felt certain the Tsar would defend Moscow, the very heart and soul of Russia. Once Moscow fell, Alexander would have to sue for peace. So Napoleon marched his haggard troops still farther east. Now, at last, the Russians turned to face the French in battle. And on September 7th, the two armies clashed near the village of Borodino, a mere 75 miles from Moscow. Napoleon no longer had enough forces or cavalry to attempt his usual flanking maneuver, so he was forced to attack the enemy head-on. The Russians fought bitterly, harder than any army Napoleon had ever faced. Even so, after hours of brutal fighting, the Russians retreated yet again. The road to Moscow lay open, but the Russian army was still intact, and Napoleon's forces had suffered horrific casualties. 7 days later, Napoleon's army, now reduced to 100,000 men, straggled into an undefended Moscow. A French marshal wrote to his wife that the emperor's joy was overflowing. "The Russians, he thinks, will sue for peace, and I shall change the face of the world." In earlier years, when he had marched into Vienna and Berlin, he had been met as a conquering hero, with dignitaries turning over to him the keys to their cities. But Moscow was empty. No citizens, no food. A terrible fire broke out almost immediately and lasted 5 days. All of the city's water pumps had been removed, an elaborate sabotage to make Moscow still more inhospitable. Napoleon sent letters to the Tsar, offering generous terms of peace. At first, the Russians seemed willing to negotiate, but the weeks went by, and it finally became clear that they were dragging out the talks to buy time to build up their army and to let winter grow closer. Napoleon could not risk staying in Moscow another day. The Russians would soon be able to encircle his now meager force. On October 19th, he marched the remains of his army out of the Russian capital. His goal was to get to Smolensk as fast as possible. Now those undisciplined bands of Cossacks that had harassed him on the road east had formed into larger divisions, guerrilla forces of 500 men, and every day they killed off more and more French soldiers. Marching in constant fear, Napoleon's men rarely slept. Thousands succumbed to fatigue and hunger. Napoleon was forced to lead them past the nightmarish fields of Borodino, still crowded with French corpses, many half-eaten by wolves. The snow began to fall. The Russian winter set in. The French horses died from the cold, and every last soldier had to trudge through the snow on foot. Barely 40,000 made it to Smolensk. The cold was worsening. There was no time to tarry in Smolensk. Through some deft maneuvering, Napoleon managed to get his troops across the Berezina River, allowing them a clear line of retreat to the west. Then, in early December, hearing of a failed coup d'etat at home in France, he left his troops behind and headed for Paris. Of the 450,000 men in his main attack force, some 25,000 made it back. Few among the rest of the army survived as well. Napoleon had miraculously escaped to fight more wars, but he would never recoup his losses in manpower and horses. Russia was indeed his grave. Interpretation. By the time Napoleon invaded Russia, Tsar Alexander I had met him a number of times in previous years and had come to know him quite well. The emperor, Alexander saw, was an aggressive man who loved any kind of fight, even if the odds were stacked against him. He needed battles as a chance to put his genius in play. By refusing to meet him in battle, Alexander could frustrate him and lure him into a void. Vast but empty lands without food or forage, empty cities with nothing to plunder, empty negotiations, empty time in which nothing happened, and finally, the dead of winter. Russia's harsh climate would make a shambles of Napoleon's organizational genius, and as it played out, Alexander's strategy worked to perfection. Napoleon's inability to engage his enemy got under his skin. A few more miles east, one solid battle, and he could teach this cowardly foe a lesson. His emotions, irration, anger, confusion, overwhelmed his ability to strategize. How could he have come to believe, for instance, that the fall of Moscow would force the Tsar to surrender? Alexander's army was still intact, the French had grown frighteningly weak, and winter was coming. Napoleon's mind had succumbed to the powerful pull of the void that he had entered, and that led him far astray. Alexander's strategy wreaked havoc on the French soldiers as well, who were renowned for their superior discipline and fighting spirit. A soldier can endure almost anything except the expectation of a battle that never comes and a tension that is never relieved. Instead of battle, the French got endless raids and pinprick attacks that came out of nowhere, a continuous threat that gradually built into panic. While thousands of soldiers fell to disease, many, more simply, lost the will to fight. It is human nature to not be able to endure any kind of void. We hate silence, long stretches of inactivity, loneliness. Perhaps this is related to our fear of that final void, our own death. We have to fill and occupy empty space. By giving people nothing to hit, being as vaporous as possible, you play upon this human weakness. Infuriated at the absence not just of a fight, but of any kind of interaction at all, people will tend to chase madly after you, losing all power of strategic thought. It is the elusive side, no matter how weak or small its force, that controls the dynamic. The bigger the enemy, the better this strategy works. Struggling to reach you, the oversized opponent presents juicy targets for you to hit. To create the maximum psychological disturbance, you must make your attacks small but relentless, keeping your enemy's anger and frustration at a constant boil. Make your void complete. Empty negotiations, talks leading nowhere, time passing without either victory or defeat. In a world of accelerated pace and activity, this strategy will have a powerfully debilitating effect on people's nerves. The less they can hit, the harder they will fall. From The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence. Most wars are wars of contact, both forces striving to keep in touch. The Arab war should be a war of detachment, to contain the enemy by the silent threat of a vast unknown desert, not disclosing themselves till the moment of attack. From this theory came to be developed ultimately an unconscious habit of never engaging the enemy at all. This chimed with the numerical plea of never giving the enemy's soldier a target. Keys to Warfare. Over the centuries, organized war, in all its infinite variations, from primitive to modern, Asian to Western, has always tended to follow a certain logic, which is so universal as almost to seem inherent to the process. The logic is as follows. A leader decides to take his country to war and raises an army for that purpose. That army's goal is to meet and defeat the enemy in a decisive battle that will force a surrender and favorable peace terms. The strategist guiding the campaign must deal with a specific area, the theater of war. This area is most often relatively limited. Maneuvering in vast open spaces complicates the possibility of bringing the war to closure. Working within the theater of war, then, the strategist contrives to bring his army to the decisive battle in a way that will surprise the enemy or put it at a disadvantage. It is cornered, or attacked from both front and rear, or must fight uphill. To keep his forces strong enough to deliver a mortal blow, he concentrates them rather than dispersing them. Once battle begins, the army will naturally form a flank and rear that it must protect against encirclement, as well as lines of communication and supply. It may take several battles to end the war, as each side works to dominate the key positions that will give it control of the theater, but military leaders must try to end it as quickly as possible. The longer it drags on, the more the army's resources are stretched to a breaking point where the ability to fight collapses. Soldiers' morale declines with time as well. As with any human activity, however, this positive, orderly side generates a negative shadow side that contains its own form of power and reverse logic. The shadow side is guerrilla warfare. The rudiments of guerrilla warfare originated thousands of years ago when smaller nations found themselves invaded by more powerful neighbors. To survive, their armies were forced to flee the invader, for any direct engagement would have destroyed them. It soon became clear that the longer they fled and eluded battle, the more they ruined the enemy's strategies and confused it by not conforming to the usual logic of engagement. Their next step was to take this further. These early guerrilla warriors learned the value of operating in small, dispersed bands, as opposed to a concentrated army, keeping in constant motion, never forming a front, flank, or rear for the other side to hit. The enemy would want to keep the war confined to a particular space, better than to extend it over as much territory as possible, melting into the countryside, forcing the enemy to disperse itself in the chase, opening itself up to raids and pinprick attacks. The enemy would naturally want a quick end to the war, so it was desirable to drag it out as long as possible, making time an offensive weapon that consumed the enemy with friction and sagging morale. In this way, over thousands of years and through trial and error, the art of guerrilla warfare developed and was refined into its present-day form. Conventional military training and thought revolve around concentrating for battle, maneuvering within limited areas, and straining for the quick kill. Guerrilla warfare's reversal of this natural order of war makes it impossible for a conventional army to counter, hence its power. In the shadowland of reverse warfare, where none of the normal rules apply, the conventional army flounders. Done right, guerrilla warfare is virtually unbeatable. The word guerrilla, small war in Spanish, was coined in reference to the Peninsular War of 1808 to 1814, which began when Napoleon invaded Spain. Melting into their country's mountains and inhospitable terrain, the Spaniards tortured the French, making it impossible for them to profit from their superior numbers and weaponry. Napoleon was bedeviled by an enemy that attacked without forming a front or rear. The Cossack fighters, who undid him in Russia in 1812, had learned a lot from the Spanish and perfected the use of guerrilla warfare. Their harassment caused far more damage than anything the rather incompetent Russian army could inflict. This strategy has become a more powerful and prevalent tool in modern warfare for several reasons. First, by exploiting technological advances in weaponry and explosives, a small guerrilla band can cause disproportionate damage. Second, Napoleonic warfare greatly expanded the size of conventional armies, making them much more vulnerable to hit-and-run tactics from light and mobile forces. Finally, guerrilla war has been adopted for political purposes to great effect. By infusing local people with the fervor of a cause, a revolutionary leader can covertly multiply his strength. His civilian supporters can sabotage the enemy's invading force, provide valuable intelligence, and turn the countryside into an armed camp. The power of guerrilla warfare is essentially psychological. In conventional warfare, everything converges on the engagement of two armies in battle. That is what all strategy is devised for, and what the martial instinct requires as a kind of release from tension. By postponing this natural convergence indefinitely, the guerrilla strategist creates intense frustration. The longer this mental corrosion continues, the more debilitating it gets. Napoleon lost to the Russians because his strategic bearings were pushed off course. His mind fell before his army did. Because it is so psychological, guerrilla strategy is infinitely applicable to social conflict. In life, as in war, our thoughts and emotions naturally converge on moments of contact and engagement with others. We find people who are deliberately elusive, who evade contact, extremely disconcerting. Whether because we want to grab them and pin them down, or because we are so annoyed with them that we want to hit them, they pull us toward them, so that either way the elusive one controls the dynamic. Some people take this further, attacking us in ways that are evasive and unpredictable. These opponents can gain a disturbing power over our minds, and the longer they keep it up, the more we are sucked into fighting on their terms. With advances in technology that make it easier to maintain a vaporous presence, and the use of the media as both a screen and a kind of guerrilla adjunct, the power and effectiveness of this warfare in political or social battle are greatly enhanced. In heated political times, a guerrilla-style campaign, allied with some cause, can be used to wage a people's war against large entities, corporations, entrenched powers. In this kind of public combat, everyone loves to fight on the guerrilla's side because the participants are more deeply involved in the struggle, not mere cogs in a giant machine. Franklin Roosevelt was a kind of political guerrilla warrior. He liked to fight evasively and strategized to deny the Republicans any targets to hit. He used the media to make himself seem to be everywhere and to be waging a kind of people's war against moneyed interests. In classic guerrilla manner, he also reorganized the Democratic Party to make it less centralized, more mobile and fluid for local battles. For Roosevelt, though, the guerrilla approach was not so much a coherent strategy as a style. As many do, he unconsciously sensed the power in being evasive and fought that way to great effect. But to make this strategy really work, it is better to use it consciously and rationally. Guerrilla strategy may be the reverse side of war, but it has its own logic, backward yet rigorous. You cannot just improvise it anarchically. You must think and plan in a new way, mobile, dimensional, and abstract. The primary consideration should always be whether a guerrilla-style campaign is appropriate for the circumstances you are facing. It is especially effective, for instance, against an opponent who is aggressive yet clever, a man like Napoleon. These types cannot stand lack of contact with an enemy. They live to maneuver, outwit, and outhit. Having nothing to strike at neutralizes their cleverness, and their aggression becomes their downfall. It is interesting to note that this strategy works in love as well as in war, and that here too Napoleon was its victim. It was by a guerrilla-style seduction, by enticing him to chase her, giving tantalizing lures, but offering him nothing solid to grasp, that Empress Josephine made him her slave. This strategy of the void works wonders on those who are used to conventional warfare. Lack of contact is so outside their experience that it warps any strategic powers they have. Large bureaucracies are often perfect targets for a guerrilla strategy for the same reason. They are capable of responding only in the most orthodox manner. In any event, guerrilla warriors generally need an opponent that is large, slow-footed, and with bullying tendencies. Once you have determined that a guerrilla war is appropriate, take a look at the army you will use. A large conventional army is never suitable. Fluidity and the ability to strike from many angles are what counts. The organizational model is the cell, a relatively small group of men and women, tight-knit, dedicated, self-motivated, and spread out. These cells should penetrate the enemy camp itself. This is how Mao Zedong organized his army in the Chinese Revolution, infiltrating the nationalist side, causing sabotage in the cities, leaving the deceptive and terrifying impression that his men were everywhere. When U.S. Air Force Colonel John Boyd joined the Pentagon in the late 1960s to help develop jet fighters, he faced a reactionary bureaucracy dominated by commercial interests rather than military ones. The Pentagon was in dire need of reform, but a traditional bureaucratic war, an attempt to convince key staff directly and frontally of the importance of his cause, would have been a hopeless venture. Boyd would simply have been isolated and funneled out of the system. He decided to wage a guerrilla war instead. His first and most important step was to organize cells within the Pentagon. These cells were small and hard to detect, giving the reactionaries nothing to hit at when they realized they were in a war. Boyd recruited his guerrillas from among those dissatisfied with the status quo, especially the young. Young people are always more receptive to change, and they love this style of fighting. With his cells in place, Boyd had constant intelligence as to what was going on in the Pentagon, and could anticipate the timing and content of the attacks on him. He could also use these cells to spread his influence through word of mouth, infiltrating ever deeper into the bureaucracy. The main point is to avoid an organization's formal channels and tendencies for bigness and concentration. Opt for mobility instead. Make your army light and clandestine. You can also attach your guerrilla cells to a regular army, much as the Russian Cossacks supported the armies of Alexander. This mix of conventional and unconventional can prove highly effective. Once you have organized your cells, you must find a way to lure the enemy into attacking you. In war, this is generally accomplished by retreating, then turning to strike at the enemy with constant small raids and ambushes that cannot be ignored. This was the classic strategy pursued by T.E. Lawrence in Arabia during World War I. The 19th-century American financial wizard Jay Gould, a man who fought many guerrilla wars in his business life, did something similar in his daily battles. His goal was to create maximum disorder in the markets, disorder he could anticipate and exploit. One of his main adversaries was the highly aggressive mogul Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, whom he engaged in a war for control of the Erie Railroad in the late 1860s. Gould maintained an incredibly elusive presence. He would work back channels to gain influence in, for example, the New York State Legislature, which then enacted laws undermining Vanderbilt's interests. The furious Vanderbilt would go after Gould and counterattack, but Gould would by then have moved on to some other unexpected target. To deprive Vanderbilt of the strategic initiative, Gould upset him, fed his competitive and aggressive instincts, then goaded him further by giving him no target to counterattack. Gould also made skillful use of the media. He might plant a newspaper article that would suddenly sideswipe Vanderbilt, portraying him as an evil monopolist. Vanderbilt would have to respond, but that would only publicize the charge. And meanwhile, Gould's name would be nowhere in evidence. The media in this instance are perfect as both the smokescreen concealing guerrilla tactics and the vehicle conveying them. Use the media to goad your enemies, getting them to disperse their energies in defending themselves while you watch or find a new target to raid and ambush. Lacking a real battle to deal with, their frustration will mount and lead them to costly mistakes. In conventional warfare, the way you supply your army is a critical issue. In guerrilla warfare, on the other hand, you live off your enemies as much as possible, using their resources, their energy, and their power as a kind of supply base. Mao supplied his army mostly with captured equipment and food. Gould actually started out by infiltrating Vanderbilt's inner circle as a financial partner, then using Vanderbilt's immense resources to fund his mayhem. Using the enemy's materiel will help you to endure the longer length of any successful guerrilla campaign. In any event, you must plan to live cheaply, marshaling what you have for the long run. In most conflicts, time is a danger, bringing Murphy's Law into play. If anything can go wrong, it will. If your army is small and relatively self-sufficient, though, there is less to go wrong. And meanwhile, you are working to make sure that for the enemy, the passage of time is a nightmare. Morale is sinking, resources are stretched, and even great planners like Napoleon are finding themselves with problems they could never have foreseen. The effect is exponential. As unexpected problems crop up, the enemy starts making mistakes, which lead to more problems. And so it goes. Make time an offensive weapon in your strategizing. Design your maneuvers to keep your enemies just barely going, always thinking that one more battle will do the trick. You want them to deteriorate slowly. A sudden sharp setback, a clear view of the trap you are laying for them, and they will pull out before the damage is done. Let them take key positions that give them the illusion of success. They will hold on to them tenaciously as your raids and pinprick attacks grow in number. Then, as they weaken, increase the pace of these attacks. Let them hope, let them think it is all still worth it, until the trap is set. Then, break their illusion. Just as you are extending time, contrary to convention, you are also extending space. You want to bring the fight to areas outside the theater of war, to include public and international opinion, turning the war into a political and global issue, and giving the enemy too large a space to defend. Political support is invaluable to an underdog guerrilla campaign. The longer the fight is drawn out, the more the enemy seems morally unjustified and politically isolated. Always try to ally your guerrilla campaign with a cause you can defend as just and worthy. You will win your guerrilla war in one of two ways. The first route is to increase the level of your attacks as your enemies deteriorate, then finish them off, as the Russians finished off Napoleon. The other method is by turning sheer exhaustion to your advantage. You just let the enemy give up, for the fight is no longer worth the aggravation. The latter way is the better one. It costs you less in resources, and it looks better. The enemy has fallen on his own sword. But even a guerrilla campaign cannot go on forever. At a certain point, time starts to work against you as well. If the ending is taking too long, you must go on the offensive and finish the enemy off. In the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese drew out the war to a point where it was also costing them too much. That was why they launched the Tet Offensive in 1968, to greatly accelerate the deterioration of the U.S. war effort. The essence of guerrilla warfare is fluidity. The enemy will always try to adjust to what you are doing, attempting to find its feet in this unfamiliar terrain. You must be prepared to change and adopt whatever is contrary to expectation. This might mean occasionally fighting in a conventional manner, concentrating your army to attack here or there, then dispersing again. Your goal is maximum disorder and unfamiliarity. Remember, This war is psychological. It is more on the level of strategy than anything else that you give the enemy nothing to hold on to, nothing tangible to counter. It is the enemy's minds that are grasping at air, and their minds that fall first. Reversal. A guerrilla strategy is extremely hard to counter, which is what makes it so effective. If you find yourself in a fight with guerrillas and you use conventional methods to fight them, you play into their hands. Winning battles and taking territory means nothing in this kind of war. The only effective counter-strategy is to reverse the guerrillas' reversal, neutralizing their advantages. You must refuse them the freedom of time and space they need for their mayhem. You must work to isolate them, physically, politically, and morally. Above all, you must never respond in a graduated manner by stepping up your forces bit by bit, as the United States did in the Vietnam War. You need a quick, decisive victory over such an opponent. If this seems impossible, it is better to pull out while you can than to sink into the protracted war the guerrilla fighter is trying to lure you into. Here are further reflections on the strategy of the void. From The Campaigns of Napoleon by David G. Chandler. In addition to wasting an ever-increasing proportion of French manpower, the elusive Russian tactics also contributed to the mental as well as physical exhaustion of Napoleon's forces. Tip-and-run raids by small bands of Cossacks were continuous and exercised a baleful influence far in excess of the military danger they represented. The French army became increasingly subject to fits of the jitters. Captain Roeder noted one typical example in his diary. The Hessian troops were mustering for parade before the Emperor's quarters at Vitebsk on August 17th, when everything was suddenly thrown into ridiculous uproar because a few Cossacks had been sighted, who were said to have carried off a forager. The entire garrison sprang to arms, and when they had ridden out, it was discovered that they were really surrounded by only a few dozen Cossacks who were dodging about hither and thither. In this way, they will be able to bring the whole garrison to hospital in about 14 days without losing a single man. From On Partisans and Irregular Forces by J.F.A. Lumière de Corvée. Such was the system Spain used against us. 150 to 200 guerrilla bands scattered all over Spain had sworn to kill 30 or 40 Frenchmen a month each. That made 6 to 8 thousand men a month for all guerrilla bands together. The order was never to attack soldiers traveling as a body unless the guerrillas outnumbered them. But they fired on all stragglers, attacked small escorts, and sought to lay hands on the enemy's funds, couriers, and especially convoys. As all the inhabitants acted as spies for their fellow citizens, the guerrillas knew when the convoys would leave and how strong their escorts would be, and the bands would make sure they were twice the size. They knew the country very well, and they would attack furiously in the most favorable spot. Success often crowned the undertaking, but they always killed a lot of men, and the goal was achieved. As there are 12 months in the year, we were losing about 80,000 men a year without any pitched battles. The war in Spain lasted 7 years, so over 500,000 men were killed. But that includes only those killed by the guerrillas. Add the battles of Salamanca, Talavera, and Vitoria, and several others that our troops lost, the sieges, the fruitless attack on Cadiz, add to the invasion and evacuation of Portugal, the fevers and various illnesses that the temperature caused our soldiers to suffer, and you will see that we could add a further 300,000 men to that number during those 7 years. From what has been said, it will be apparent that the prime aim of this sort of war is to bring about the destruction of the enemy almost without him noticing it. And as a drop of water dripping on a stone will eventually dig a hole in the stone, patience and perseverance are needed, always following the same system. In the long run, the enemy will suffer more from this than he would from losing pitched battles. Chapter 27. Seem to work for the interests of others while furthering your own. The Alliance Strategy. The best way to advance your cause with the minimum of effort and bloodshed is to create a constantly shifting network of alliances, getting others to compensate for your deficiencies, do your dirty work, fight your wars, spend energy pulling you forward. The art is in choosing those allies who fit the needs of the moment and fill the gaps in your power. Give them gifts. Offer them friendship. Help them in time of need. All to blind them to reality and put them under subtle obligation to you. At the same time, work to sow dissension in the alliance of others, weakening your enemies by isolating them. While forming convenient coalitions, keep yourself free of negative entanglements. The Perfect Ally. In 1467, Charles, the 34-year-old Count of Charolais, received the news he had secretly longed for. His father, the Duke of Burgundy, known as Philip the Good, had died, making Charles the new duke. Father and son had clashed over the years. Philip was patient and practical, and during his reign had slowly managed to expand Burgundy's already impressive holdings. Charles was more ambitious and more warlike. The empire he inherited was immense, including Flanders, Holland, Zeeland, and Luxembourg to the north of present-day France, and the important Duchy of Burgundy itself in northeastern France. Now, as Duke, Charles had the power and resources at his command to realize his dreams of conquest into Germany and beyond. Two obstacles stood in his path. The first was the independent Swiss cantons to Burgundy's east. Charles would have to incorporate this territory by force before moving into southern Germany. The Swiss were fierce warriors who would not take kindly to any invasion. But in the end, they could hardly match the size and power of the Duke's army. The second obstacle was King Louis XI of France, Charles's cousin and arch-rival since childhood. France then was still a feudal state, composed of several duchies like Burgundy, whose dukes owed allegiance to the king. But these duchies were in fact independent powers, and could form their own league if the king dared provoke them. Burgundy was the most powerful duchy of them all, and everyone knew Louis dreamed of swallowing it up and making France a united power. Charles, however, felt confident that he could best his older cousin in both diplomacy and warfare. After all, Louis was weak, even a little soft in the head. How else to explain his strange infatuation with the Swiss cantons? Almost from the beginning of his reign, Louis had courted them assiduously, treating them almost like equals to France. There were many more powerful states he could have allied himself with to increase France's power, but he seemed obsessed with the Swiss. Perhaps he felt an affinity to their simple lifestyle. For a king, he himself had rather peasant tastes. Louis also had an aversion toward warfare, preferring to buy peace, even at a high price, than to fund an army. It was imperative that Charles strike now, before Louis wised up and started acting more like a king. Charles formed a plan to realize his ambitions, and then some. He would first move into Alsace, between France and Germany, and swallow up the weak kingdoms in the area. Then he would form an alliance with the great warrior king of England, Edward IV, whom he would persuade to land a large army at Calais. His own army would link up with the English at Reims, in central France, where Edward would be crowned the country's new king. The Duke and Edward would easily dispose of Louis's weak army. The Duke could then march east across the Swiss cantons, while Edward would march south. Together, they would form the dominant power in Europe. By 1474, everything was in place. Edward had signed on to the plan. The Duke began by marching on the Upper Rhine, but just as he began his maneuvers, he learned that a large Swiss army had invaded his home territory of Burgundy. This army was funded by Louis XI himself. By this action, Louis and the Swiss were clearly sending a warning to the Duke that they would not look kindly on any future invasion of the cantons. But Charles had enough forces in Burgundy to drive the Swiss out. He was not a man to provoke in such a way. Both parties would more than pay for their rash invasion. In the summer of 1475, the English army, the largest yet assembled for an invasion of France, landed at Calais under the personal leadership of Edward IV. Charles went to meet Edward to finalize their plans and toast their imminent conquests. He then quickly returned to his own troops, which were marching through Lorraine in preparation for the great link-up with the English forces at Reims. Suddenly, some disturbing news reached Charles in the field. His spies at the French court reported that Louis had opened up secret negotiations with Edward. Apparently, Louis had persuaded the English king that Charles was using him and could not be trusted. Knowing that England's finances were weak, Louis had offered generous terms of peace, amounting to a large annual pension paid directly to the king and his court. He had entertained the English with great feasts of food and ale. And then, to the Duke's utter disgust and amazement, Edward fell for it, signed the treaty, and took his forces home. The Duke had barely had time to get over this bitter news when Louis suddenly sent him envoys to broker a long-term truce between France and Burgundy. This was typical of the king. Everything he did was inconsistent and contradictory. What was he thinking? Signing the truce would mean the Duke could now confidently march against the Swiss, knowing that France would not interfere. Perhaps the king was guided by his great fear of war? Charles happily approved the truce. The Swiss were outraged. Louis had been their friend, and now, at the moment of imminent peril, he had abandoned them. But the Swiss were used to fighting on their own. They would simply have to mobilize every man available. In the dead of the winter of 1477, the Duke, impatient for victory, crossed the Jura Mountains, heading east. The Swiss were waiting for him near the town of Grandson. This was the first time the Duke had done battle with the Swiss, and he was caught off guard by what confronted him. It began with the alarming bellow of Swiss battle horns, which echoed in the mountains, creating a frightening din. Next, thousands of Swiss soldiers advanced down the slope toward the Burgundians. They marched with perfect precision, packed tight in phalanxes from which their enormous pikes stuck out like the spines of a giant hedgehog in motion. Their flanks and rear were protected by halberdiers swinging spiked battle axes. It was a terrifying sight. The Duke ordered attack after attack with his cavalry to break up the phalanxes, only to watch them being slaughtered. His artillery was hard to maneuver in the mountainous terrain. The Swiss fought with incredible fierceness, and their phalanxes were impenetrable. A reserve Swiss force, hidden in the woods on the Burgundian right, suddenly emerged and attacked. The Duke's army fell into a headlong retreat. The battle ended in a slaughter, from which the Duke, however, escaped. A few months later, it was the turn of the Swiss to go on the offensive by marching into Lorraine. In January 1478, the Duke counterattacked with his now enfeebled forces. Again, the Burgundians were routed, and this time the Duke did not escape. His body was finally identified on the field of battle, his head cloven in two by a Swiss halberd, his body pierced by pikes. In the months after Charles's death, Louis XI swallowed up Burgundy, eliminating the last great feudal threat to a unified France. The Duke had unknowingly fallen prey to Louis's elaborate plan to destroy him without wasting a single French soldier. Interpretation. King Louis XI would eventually become known as the Spider King, infamous for the elaborate webs he would weave to ensnare his opponents. His genius was to think far ahead and plot an indirect path to his goals, and his greatest goal was to transform France from a feudal state into a unified great power. Burgundy was his largest obstacle, and one he could not meet head-on. His army was weaker than Charles's, and he did not want to provoke a civil war. Before he became king, though, Louis had fought a short campaign against the Swiss and had seen the brutal efficiency with which their phalanxes fought, and how they used their mountainous terrain to perfect advantage. He thought them unbeatable in war. Louis formed a plan to bait Charles into invading the cantons, where his military machine would be destroyed. The strands of Louis's web were finely woven. First, he spent years courting the Swiss, forging bonds that blinded them to his ulterior purpose. This alliance also befuddled the arrogant duke, who could not imagine how Louis planned to make use of such an ally. The king also knew that by getting the Swiss to invade Burgundy in 1474, he would make the duke so enraged as to lose all patience in his desire for revenge. When Edward landed at Calais, the king had foreseen the invasion and was ready for it. Instead of trying to fight off this mighty opponent, he worked to coax the English king away from his alliance with Burgundy by appealing to his self-interest. Without risking a single battle so far from home, Edward would receive a financial payment too handsome to refuse. Again, thinking far in advance, Louis knew that when he eventually swallowed up the wealthy duchy of Burgundy, he would more than recoup what he was having to pay Edward. Abandoned by the English, Charles was isolated, yet still determined to avenge the invasion of Burgundy. At this point, Louis moved to sign a treaty with the duke, getting rid of the last possible obstacle in Charles's path to the Swiss cantons. This new treaty would infuriate his Swiss friends, but what did Louis care? Friendship meant little to him. The Swiss would fight to defend their land with or without him. Patient and clear about his goals, Louis used alliances as a form of bloodless warfare, crushing his opponents by getting others to do his work for him. Almost all of us instinctively understand the importance of allies. Because we operate by feel and emotion more often than by strategy, however, we frequently make the worst kinds of alliances. A common mistake is to think that the more allies we have, the better. But quality is more important than quantity. Having numerous allies increases the chances we will become entangled in other people's wars. Going to the other extreme, we sometimes think a single powerful ally is all we need. But allies like that tend to get what they can from us and then drop us when our usefulness is exhausted, just as Louis dropped the Swiss. It is, in any case, a mistake to become dependent on one person. Finally, we sometimes choose those who seem the friendliest, who we think will be loyal. Our emotions lead us astray. Understand, the perfect allies are those who give you something you cannot get on your own. They have the resources you lack. They will do your dirty work for you or fight your battles. Like the Swiss, they are not always the most obvious or the most powerful. Be creative and look for allies to whom you in turn have something to offer as well, creating a link of self-interest. To lose such allies of convenience will not destroy you or make you feel betrayed. You must think of them as temporary tools. When you no longer need such tools, there is no love lost in dumping them. From The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. The forces of a powerful ally can be useful and good to those who have recourse to them, but are perilous to those who become dependent on them. False alliances. In November 1966, Murray Bowen, a professor of clinical psychiatry at Georgetown University and one of the world's most influential family therapists, faced a brewing crisis within his own family back home in Waverly, Tennessee. Bowen was the oldest of five children. His family had operated an important business in Waverly for several generations. The third oldest sibling, a brother nicknamed June, had been running the business for some time. Continually overworked and feeling underappreciated, June was now asking for a controlling interest in the business. Their father supported him, their mother did not. Members of the extended family were taking sides. The situation was tense. At the same time, a death in the family of June's wife had made her so despondent that it was beginning to affect her husband's health. A ripple effect was spreading to the rest of the family, and Bowen's sister, the second youngest and most unstable sibling, was beginning to display all kinds of nervous symptoms. Bowen feared most, though, for his father, who had a weak heart. As a family therapist, Bowen had studied a phenomenon he called an anxiety wave, in which a peripheral event could spark enough emotional turmoil to lead to the death of the family's oldest or most vulnerable member. Somehow, Bowen had to find a way to diffuse this anxiety wave in his own family. The problem for Bowen was that he was also going through a kind of personal and professional crisis at the time. One of his most influential theories held that members of a family were healthy to the extent that they could differentiate themselves from their siblings and parents, establishing their own identity, being able to make decisions on their own, while also being integrated and actively involved with the rest of the family. He saw this as a difficult psychic task for anyone. A family has a kind of group ego and an interlocking emotional network. It requires a great deal of effort and practice to establish autonomy outside this system. Yet doing so, Bowen believed, though crucial for everyone, was also professionally necessary for family therapists who could not properly help others if they had been unable to differentiate themselves from their own families. They would carry their personal problems into their practice. And indeed, here was Professor Bowen, a man in his early 50s who had worked for years on his relationship to his family, but who found himself sucked into the group dynamic, regressing emotionally, unable to think straight, every time he went home to Tennessee. That made him feel profoundly frustrated and depressed. The time had come, he decided, to attempt a radical, personal experiment on his next visit home. In late January 1967, June Bowen received a lengthy letter from his brother Murray. The two men had not written to each other for some time. In fact, June resented his brother and had avoided personal encounters with him for several years, for he felt that their mother always took Murray's side, even though it was June who was running the business. In the letter, Murray passed on many gossipy stories about June that family members had told him over the years, always careful to add that Murray had better not let his sensitive brother hear them. Murray said he was tired of these stories and of being told how to manage his brother. It would be better, he thought, to communicate with June directly. He ended the letter by saying it would be unnecessary for the two of them to see each other on his next visit home, since he had told him everything he wanted to say. He signed the letter, "Your Meddlesome Brother." The more June thought about this letter, the angrier it made him. Murray had deliberately churned up division between June and his family. Then, a few days later, the two men's younger sister also received a letter from Murray, saying he had heard about her emotional distress and had written asking June to take care of her until he got home. He signed the letter, "Your Worried Brother." This letter was as upsetting to the sister as June's letter had been to him. She was tired of people treating her as if she were sick. That only made her more anxious than she already was. After another short interval, Murray sent a third letter, this time to his mother. He mentioned the letters he had written to the others. He was trying to diffuse the family crisis, he said, by attracting all attention to himself. He wrote that he had wanted to get his brother all roiled up, and that he had the material to push even more buttons if necessary. But, he warned, it is never wise to share intelligence with the enemy, so his mother should keep all this to herself. He signed the letter, "Your Strategic Son." Thinking he had lost his mind, his mother burned the letter. News of these letters passed quickly through the family, stirring up a hornet's nest of accusations, concerns, and anxieties. Everyone was in a tizzy about them, but June was the center of the storm. He showed Murray's letter to his mother, whom it greatly disturbed. June promised that on Murray's imminent visit home, he would not only not avoid him, but would confront him and really let him have it. Murray arrived in Waverly in early February. On the second night of his visit, at a dinner at his sister's, June showed up with his wife. The brother's father and mother were also present. The encounter lasted some 2 hours, its main participants, Murray, June, and their mother. It was a bitter family confrontation. A furious June threatened a lawsuit over Murray's scurrilous stories and accused his mother of conspiring with her favorite. When Murray confirmed that he and his mother were in cahoots, that it had all been plotted years ago between him and Mom, she was outraged, denied knowledge of any plot, and said she would never tell Murray anything again. June told his own stories about his professor brother. Murray responded that they were amusing, but he knew better ones. The entire conversation centered on personal issues, and many repressed emotions came to the surface. But Murray remained strangely detached. He made sure he took no sides. No one was quite happy with what he was saying. The next day, Murray showed up at June's house, and June, for some reason, was happy to see him. Murray told more gossipy stories, including one he had heard about how well June was handling the situation, considering all the stress he was under. June, feeling quite emotional, started to open up to his brother about his problems. He was really worried about their sister, he said, even thought she might be retarded. Later that day, Murray visited the sister and told her what June had said about her. She was more than able to take care of herself, she replied, and had had enough of the family's intrusive concern. More visits followed with other family members. In each case, whenever someone tried to pass along some gossip or get Murray to take his or her side in the family constellation,